took one step further and we were looking into the eyes of four lionesses and two cubs. And the fourth lioness with the two cubs exited stage left down the ravine like a shot. The other three lionesses jumped up at us. We ran backwards yelling at the tops of our lungs. The lions came up towards us. Their teeth were pulled back in grimace. The noise was beyond belief. You could see their claws were out. They were moving at us fast and then stopping. And every time they stopped, a big puff of dust.
That is Brian Keating, one of Canada's top naturalists, educators, and wildlife expedition leaders. He's our guest on this episode of Explore, a Canadian Geographic podcast. Welcome to all you explorers out there, armchair and in motion. I'm your host, David McGuffin. I've got a little breaking news for you here on the podcast, not our usual thing, but listen, Canadian Geographic is now the number one paid magazine in Canada with a monthly readership of 4.3 million people online and in print. That's according to Vivadata, which is a not-for-profit organization that provides marketing research on print and online readership in Canada. So how fantastic is that and how thoroughly well-deserved? Canadian Geographic's been at this for a while now. It's been publishing Canadian Geographic magazine for over 90 years. It's won boatloads of awards for its unique and brilliant reporting, photography, and maps. And if you don't have a subscription, the good news is there's still plenty of room on this bandwagon. It's only $28.50 a year. That gets you full digital access and bi-monthly delivery of 6 print editions. To sign up, go to canadiangeographic.ca/subscribe. You'll be happy that you did. Brian Keating is a very good example of the kind of great people you'll find writing for Canadian Geographic magazine. And I'm really, really happy to have him today on this podcast. He's not only one of Canada's leading naturalists, he and his wife Dee are also both RCGS fellows. For decades, they've led expeditions from pole to pole and all 7 continents. Brian himself has inspired generations of people to get out, experience, appreciate, and protect our wild spaces. He does this with regular appearances on the CBC, Discovery Channel, and the National Geographic Channel. He spent almost 30 years as the Director of Education and Outreach at the Calgary Zoo. Brian and I also share a love and fascination for both sub-Saharan Africa and the Canadian Arctic. So buckle in. This is a fun ride. Brian Keating, welcome to the Explore podcast.
Well, thank you, David. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here.
Well, it's certainly great to have you here. And what I want to find out is where that spark of adventure, where that spark of interest in our natural world, where that came from.
When I was 12 years old, I developed an interest in nature and specifically in bird watching. And I wanted to build a museum. So I collected stuff from the nearby woods and then I'd bring it home and I would make displays and then do the research on it and put these displays up. Displays like praying mantis nests, which ultimately had a kind of a frustrating end point because all the youngsters hatched out inside the house and my mother was rather upset with me. But I worked on this museum for years, bird nests, mounted on little wooden structures and so on. And that got me outside. My mother bought me a secondhand pair of binoculars, which slowed me down. And it allowed me to see the glint in the eye of the robin hopping along the front lawn. And it showed me the beauty of nature. And my gosh, it just became a passion. And that interest has followed me throughout my life.
Amazing. And so this is Medicine Hat, Alberta, yeah?
Actually, we moved from Medicine Hat to New York. My sister was born deaf, and my parents wanted her to learn how to speak so that she could communicate in a hearing world as well as the deaf world. So the only place that taught kids how to lip read in those days, there's 2 places, but one of them was in New York City, Lexington School for the Deaf. So we lived on Long Island, and my dad would drive her into the city for early Monday morning, and she'd stay there all week and pick her up on Friday. And to this day, she's, you know, I've met a lot of deaf people in my life, but she's probably one of the best, one of the best speakers that I've ever met. She's very good. So that was a good move on my parents' part and a huge commitment. But fortunately, there was a 20-acre woodlot nearby that was a 5-minute walk from my front door. And that's where I spent a lot of time.
Oh, amazing. And that's right on, obviously, on the Atlantic coast there. I'm sure there's like that's migratory bird routes and all sorts of stuff going.
Totally. Yeah. To this day, I can remember seeing my first bay-breasted warbler. You know, I was sitting by myself with my bird book and my binoculars, and it came along, and it had some very distinguishing marks, and I figured it out. And, you know, I was 12 years old, and I can still remember the elation that I felt of figuring out what bird that was. And so those are pretty important experiences to have when you're a little kid.
So what you've got this sort of notion of something, right, as a child. How does that then translate into you becoming sort of the director of outreach and education at the Calgary Zoo? What's the path there?
Well, you know, I suppose being in the right place at the right time, and I when I give lectures to students and talk about career paths, I explain my own career path as being in a canoe floating down a river following the current. And whenever I saw an interesting bit of current that would lead me away from the mainstream, I took it. Basically because out of interest, not necessarily because of the destination that it would take me to. And so by you know, just this focused intent of trying to do something with my interest, I landed a job with the Canadian Wildlife Service in southern Saskatchewan, which eventually brought me, well, I first landed it in southern British Columbia, and then that eventually took me to southern Saskatchewan. So here I was being paid to learn learn about these very different ecosystems. And then the education directorship opened up at the Calgary Zoo, and my wife had then, she was going to university in Calgary, and long-distance relationships only work so good for so long before they don't work at all. And so I managed to get back to Calgary, and both my relationship with my then girlfriend, now wife, and my career have both flourished.
That's amazing. You're at the Calgary Zoo, and you were there for about, you know, almost 3 decades, you know.
Yeah.
And what are the highlights of that time there? What stands out to you?
Well, you know, I guess the surprise of what the zoo allowed me to do. You know, when I didn't work with the zoo, when I worked with the Canadian Wildlife Service, I thought really not much about zoos. I thought they just entrapped animals and, you know, what good are they? But when I started to work at the zoo, when I first started to apply for the job and figure out why I wanted to work at the zoo, I realized that it opens up a huge doorway to get people in to talk about nature. And that was my gig in those days, was interpretation, nature interpretation, to spread the word about the value of intact ecosystems. And the zoo basically is an opportunity for people to come from every walk of life. It's not really an example of what nature is, but it gives a window onto what nature can be. And nature is exciting. It is colorful. It is beautiful. It is diverse. Sure, the zoos usually show the big glamorous stuff, but what a great entryway into the minds of people to get them to think about the importance of intact ecosystems.
Yeah, I lived in Washington, D.C., and I lived near the National Zoo, so just like a short walk away. And the beauty of all those things in D.C. is they're all free, so I could just walk in and out whenever I wanted. And if I was having a bad day, I would just go hang out with the gorillas, you know?
And that's a good way to spend a day. When I worked at the zoo, if I was having a frustrating moment, I would just phone up the elephant keepers and ask if I could come over and play with the elephants for a while. And what, in those days, you could do that. Obviously, things are different now. But my gosh, what an opportunity. And it also opened up my scope. When I worked with the Canadian Wildlife Service, I was very much into either southern British Columbia, Selkirk, Purcell, mountain, forest, marshland environments. When I was in the prairies, it was very different again, but all Canadian-based. When I came to the zoo, suddenly my world opened up to the world. And that's what gave me a new opportunity to explore different habitat or different wildlife. And then the opportunity when I started to look at other ways of expanding my zoo work, I started leading trips as a nature guide to these different parts of the world. And oh my gosh, then the whole world opened up, and it has been opening ever since.
Yeah. The intriguing parts I find of your career, I mean, you do a lot of time in the polar regions and have spent a lot of time with it, but you also spent a lot of time in Africa, which I also have spent time in as well.
Yes.
Can you tell me about your first trip to Africa and what memories stand out from that?
Oh, geez. It was, you know, I was looking at, at the opportunity of potentially running some trips as an excuse for a very diverse education program. But it also ultimately turned out into a wonderful way to make money for the zoo, to fundraise, which at the end of the day, all of that money went into conservation programs. So I felt very good about the whole concept. But that first trip, it was to Zimbabwe. There was only about seven or eight of us on the trip. We were all zoo people. It was hosted by an American company that ran tours to Africa, and they were primarily promoting Zimbabwe because Kenya was sort of taken by other companies, and Zimbabwe was just opening up to the world. And so, you know, I'll never forget, we went at the worst time of the year to go to Zimbabwe. It was right in the middle of the rainy season, but it was a beautiful time of the year with everything lush and green. The bird life was over the top, and the insect life was amazing. But it took us, I think it was 3 days when we were in Hwange National Park before we saw our first elephant. When you go during the dry season, you'll see your first 300 elephants within the first afternoon. So, but I'll never forget that first time seeing my first elephant and how mind-blowing that was. And my first time seeing lions. And as we were driving across the terrain to get up closer to the lions, we had to swerve around a giant leopard tortoise about the size of a basketball on the ground. That was my first time seeing a leopard tortoise. And then when we got to the lions, they were facing off to a cobra. And the cobra looked like it was about 3 or more meters long. It was upright. It had its hood out. And the lions were wondering, what is this thing? And of course, they, you know, it ended peacefully, but it could have ended very differently. But it was just remarkable. So all these overwhelming firsts. And I always said that those, especially those first trips to Africa, I had this overwhelmed feeling every time I went out. And I love that overwhelmed feeling where everything I'm looking at is new. Every bird call is different. It just really turns my crank. And as a naturalist from a young age, this was like walking into a child's imagination. You know, I mean, where else are horses dressed in pajamas? And there's animals with necks that are seriously long to get at the leaves. And there's other animals with long noses that act as a fifth limb, a trunk, you know, and it goes on and on and on. I mean, come on, give me a break. A hippo, really? Are they really real? Here's a sausage with a suitcase for a mouth.
Yeah, no, incredible. and I saw a hippo one morning running in the Masai Mara, flying. Like, yeah. You'd never assume something that big, you know?
I know.
Could make that much speed, yeah.
They run like a racehorse.
Yeah.
They say that the most important thing you can do when if there's a hippo, if you happen to surprise a hippo on land and you're on foot, make sure you don't get between the hippo and the water, because the place that the hippo feels safe is in the water, and he will run at a high speed. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I had some Kenyans who were trying to convince me that you have to run at them and then do like a figure eight and then run away. And I'm like, I don't see myself running at it. Like, I don't.
I think your Kenyan friends were teasing the new boy on the block.
I think they might well have been, yeah. There was probably beers involved at that point, too.
That's right.
End of a long day driving around the Masai Mara, but yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's an amazing place. I always tell people, it's like, you know, those wall charts you would have up in a classroom, maybe it shows all the animal wildlife from a certain place, except for it's like that in real life there. You could see all that right in front of you. There's like 12 different species, all sort of in large numbers, small numbers.
Yeah, I remember describing to people about Zimbabwe and standing up on a termite mound along in the Manapools National Park, which is along the Zambezi River. And you could do a 360 degree in this forest with your binoculars looking, and you could count easily a dozen large species. And up above, there'll be vervet monkeys and crowned egrets or eagles, you know, the call of hippos in the background, the barking of baboons off in the distance, and it goes on and on. It is really an overwhelming environment. And many of those parks fortunately still exist like that. So I go back to Africa every year. I was just back in Zimbabwe last October, and in some places are actually better than they were when I first went there over 30 years ago.
Well, that's very heartening to hear, because there was some, I think definitely, so I left in 2010. I haven't been back yet, and that needs to be corrected clearly. But But there was concerns about poaching that was actually on the rise again, having been sort of stemmed in the early 2000s and stuff. But what you're seeing, it's leveling again in places?
You know, it's here and there. In some places, it's horrible. Overall, I think the picture is doesn't look good for the future. I mean, the human population is growing. That buffer zone along the edge of the Serengeti, for instance, is narrowing. And so now there are villages that are right up against the edge of the park. So I think ultimately there's, you know, if it weren't for the tourists that are going there to keep those parks active, they probably, many of them would have disappeared a long time ago. But I'm heartened when I look at a place like Zimbabwe that went through so much hell when Mugabe went crazy, and yet there were people that I've known for over 30 years that are still that stayed there during those difficult times, and that stayed there because of their desire to make sure the wildlife didn't disappear. And people like Clive Stockhill, who is quite a famous guy in the conservation world, he has moved mountains, and yet his barriers that he had to overcome were just incredible. And yet he's pulled it off, and he's still there, and he's still moving mountains, and is still doing it with the kind of energy and vigor that he had when I first met him decades ago.
Mm. What's his focus? Well,
right now he's in Gonorezo, which is in the southern part of the country. He's he also had a park that he built in the Save region of, it's called Save Reserve, and he inherited the land from his father. His father was a cattle rancher, but in 1992, all the cattle in southern Zimbabwe, most of the cattle died in the huge drought. And so his ranching buddies that were, you know, surrounding his property, they said, well, you know, I guess we just have to walk away from our land. And he said, well, wait a minute, let's think about this. I grew up on this land. And when I was a kid, I saw giraffe, and I saw elephant, and I saw buffalo, and there was a half dozen species of antelope, and everything seemed to work. It's only when we came in and brought in the cows that the overgrazing, because you have to do that in a marginal landscape if you're going to make a buck, the overgrazing situation created the perfect storm for when bad weather, when a drought came, it just virtually wiped everything out. And so his thought was, why don't we recreate that landscape that I grew up with and take down all of the internal fences, get rid of the barbed wire, get rid of the cattle, go to the international community for funding, and basically build a national park. And he did that. And the landscape is huge. It's about 1 million hectares that he ended up overseeing. Many of the ranchers stayed there, but they bought on to the idea of creating a park that would invite tourists in for photographic safaris, if that's what they wanted on their piece of land, or if they wanted to, they could bring in hunting safaris, if that's, but the hunting quota had to be monitored and adhered to by an international a non-governmental organization, so that you couldn't say, well, this year I'm going to take out 15 leopard. Well, what's your basis on that? Well, that's how many I want to take. So you can't do that. You have to follow the guidance of professional ecologists. So he did that, and the park has become very successful. And it's in the process now of being gazetted by the National Parks of Zimbabwe, which is a good news story, because that will eventually make it part of the national park system and part of a much bigger system that allows connectivity all the way from Kruger in South Africa up through Gonorezo in southern Zimbabwe, which is a huge national park, and all the way up into the Save and further into Mozambique.
Wow, so, that's huge. It's a huge amount of territory. Yeah.
It is, and it's very exciting, and it's coming together. And just to give you an idea, the Gonorezo, which I was in just a few months ago, Clive has a lodge on the edge of Gonorezo, and somehow he managed to keep that lodge operating even during COVID, and he's, you know, it's now everything has gotten much better. But about a decade and a half ago, a very wealthy individual who we still don't know the name of, I've got a few ideas who it might be, but donated $30 million through the Frankfurt Zoological Society to set up an anti-poaching system in Gonorezo. And basically they fixed the poaching problem. And
wow.
Gonorezo, I ignored Gonorezo in my earlier years of visiting Zimbabwe because I had heard it was just a park on paper, basically what we call an empty park. The forest was essentially devoid of wildlife. But since they started this intense anti-poaching system, they keep the they've trained the anti-poaching team well. They've hired from local villages. Many of them used to be poachers, so they know the terrain and they know how the mindset of how poachers operate. They keep them there during the wet season, which is when poachers had a heyday before because no tourists were there, so things could happen unbeknownst to any outside eyeballs. And the park has become magnificent. Since the influx of elephants from Kruger and other areas have created a good, healthy elephant population. They're still nervous. You know, elephants don't forget. There's no doubt about it. But at least you see elephants. And I've had some profound experiences with elephants there. Lion population is coming back up. Wild dogs have, which is the African painted wolf, they've come in good numbers. The impala population has gone through the roof, as they always do. Because of that, the predators are reacting accordingly. And it's a huge park. It's one that you pretty well need a GPS to find your way through. There's no paved roads, no services. It's a big wilderness chunk that is now thriving with wildlife.
That's fascinating. And the return to predators, I find that always fascinating too, because there's all these studies that I've done in North America about what the impact of a return to wolves like Yellowstone is, like the one big, you know, and just what it does for the ecosystem. And it improves like fairly dramatically, doesn't it?
It sure does. Yeah. You know, and it just makes a complete ecosystem. It would, you know, I can't imagine hiking in our own Rocky Mountains if there were no grizzly bears. It would be just such a sad place to be. Yeah. But it's exciting to know that there's grizzly bears and cougars and wolverines out there because it does make a system, an ecosystem complete.
Yeah. Tell me about you've done a lot of travels in the Arctic too. Where are places up there that have stood out for you, or trips you've done?
Well, I was really lucky, David. At 21 years of age, I was going to college. I was going to become a park warden or a ranger or something. And I was in my first year of college. And a fellow that I met there had just come back from the year before. He had spent 4 months up at a weather station, just 1,000 kilometers this side of the North Pole. And he told me the stories, showed me the pictures. And, you know, I mean, I just love exploring new habitats, and I like places of extreme. I've always liked high mountains and desert situations and so on. And he showed me how he applied for the job and got it as a handyman at a weather station.
So this is Ellesmere?
It's Ellesmere Island at Eureka on the Fosheim Peninsula.
Wow.
It's about 1,000 kilometers south of the North Pole.
Yeah.
And it's just across from Axel Heiberg Island, which is, I think, the fourth largest uninhabited island in the world or something like that. It's got a title, something like that. Anyway, so at 21 years of age, I hopped on an airplane and flew up to Resolute Bay and then north to Eureka, spent 4 months there. And it was really an experience that I will never forget because, you know, living here in the South, it's a complicated environment, David. When you're 21 years old, you know, there's homework, there's college, there's deadlines, there's work to try to make ends meet financially, there's girls, you know, all the things that come with the Southern environment. And when I was up there, it was just me. And I had a buddy that I worked with, we're friends to this day still with, he and I pushed each other and we hiked incredible distances and had amazing experiences with wolves, with muskox. I saw my first seal when I was there. We had a Newfoundlander living at the weather station. There's only 12 of us, and one of them was a Newfoundlander. And there, I decided that they're genetically infused with the ability to build a rowboat virtually overnight.
It's the Dory gene, yeah.
So we built a boat out of 3/8-inch plywood. It was maybe half-inch plywood. Painted it international orange. Called it the John B. McDonald after the John A. McDonald icebreaker that was serving the Arctic with supplies. And we found a 25-horsepower Evinrude in a box up at the strip left behind by an oil company. And we put that on and then that opened up a whole new level of exploration for us. It got us to the other side of what was known as Slidre Fjord, which is the fjord in front of Eureka, gave us new hiking opportunities, and we boated out to icebergs, and it ultimately boated out to the John A. McDonald and went around it and around it and around it until the captain came out and invited us aboard.
How to get a meal in the high Arctic.
That's right. Yeah. So that was my first Arctic experience. And then, you know, I fell in love with that alpine environment and I could fill that niche by mountaineering down here, which I was very much involved in.
Can we just stay on Ellesmere for a second, though, too? Because I've had a couple of guests on, Ray Zahab and Laval Saint-Germain, actually, a
yes.
friend of yours as well. So and both of them were going on. I'll preface this. I think most of us here in the South think it's just blasted ice wasteland up there. But yeah. they were going on Mount Ellesmere, just the amount and the varied amount of wildlife that they saw when they were there. And you saw muskox, you were saying, but what else were you?
Oh, it's phenomenal. It's called the garden spot of the Arctic. At least Eureka is. It's called the garden spot of the Arctic for a good reason. There's lots of hills, valleys, ravines. Blacktop Mountain was about a 4 or 5 hour walk away, about a 3,000, about 1,000 vertical meter ascent to the top of Black Rock. So it gave us lots of different terrain to explore, shales and cliffs and so on. So that just from that perspective, it's a far cry from many of the other further south Arctic islands that are really flat gravel beds. This one had diversity of terrain. And because of that, it would accumulate snow in these valleys that would melt out all summer long, creating a water opportunity for the plants down below. So many of these valleys were just filled with all kinds of heathers and other plants and just created an opportunity for Arctic hare and for caribou. I saw the Peary's caribou when I was up there on several occasions, which is Canada's rarest caribou. It's our furthest northern caribou. I think it's Canada's prettiest caribou, and it's our own. It turns virtually pure white in the winter. They're a stockier, shorter caribou compared to the other subspecies with the males have a beautiful rack. And the first time I came across them, my buddy and I had sat down on some stones and we were eating some lunch or something, and all of a sudden the snow patch that was about 100 meters away started to move. That was the caribou, and they were on the snow cooling down, but they got nervous about our presence after a period of time and got up. So suddenly we realized we were in the presence of caribou, and we did the best thing we could have done. We sat still and opened up our cameras, pulled out the film that we had in, and put in new rolls of film in the days of Kodachrome. And so we would have a roll of 36 fresh. And the caribou got curious about what we were doing and approached us. So we sat and had these caribou come right over. And so that was a very important lesson for me. You know, we too often we behave like predators approaching wildlife. Well, sometimes you should just chill and let the animal get used to you, and especially in an environment like that where they had probably never seen people before. And we had experiences with muskox too. It was several months or a month or so into my 4-month stint at Eureka, before an airplane pilot came in and said, "Hey, I saw a herd of muskox a few miles up Station Creek," which was the creek that gave us our fresh water. So my buddy and I immediately hiked in that direction, and that's where we saw our first muskox, and I'll never forget it. And we had muskox experience after muskox experience all summer. We would sit on a ridge and watch a family group of muskox in a boggy environment, feeding and playing. We would watch young muskox do goofy things just to what appeared to be to piss off mom. And then she would put the young muskox in its place. What I'm saying is they have behavior. When we watched them for a period of time, they're not just long-haired cows. They're actually creatures with personality. And I had never made that connection before until I had the opportunity to watch. It was the summer we were there, too. We had an Arctic hare boom. So the population, the North is famous for huge population swings of animals like lemmings and hares. And the Arctic hare, which is a pure white hare, and the largest of all the hares, their population was at its max the summer that I was there. And they started to amass in big populations, later in the summer. And a couple of times, my buddy and I were able to get on our hands and knees and pretend we were grazing animals, just doing our thing. And we would get up within meters of 300, 400, 500 hares, and we'd lie on our belly and photograph them and watch them, and watching hares do what hares do when they're in the Arctic, not feeling threatened, you know, scratching themselves, resting, playing around. It was really an exceptional experience for a 21-year-old. I think the highlight, though, I remember that I've told this story before. I was hiking by myself one evening. It was after I'd finished doing the dishes in the evening, and I went for a walk for a couple of hours. One hill drew me over the next one, which drew me over the next one. Finally, I looked at my watch, and it was about midnight, and I thought, I got to get back, get a few hours of sleep before I have to start work the next day. So I start. Remember, it's 24-hour sunlight. So I'm walking back. I came up over a hill, and there was a pack of 7 or 8 wolves. And they were just hanging out on the tundra. So I lay down on my belly, pulled my binoculars out, used my elbows as a tripod, and just watched probably for an hour before I thought, I got to go, because this is just too much. But I watched them do what wolves do. And it was so exciting and so fantastic. And I sat up. And I knew I was going to scare them because I had to walk past them, even though I was going to go around them to try not to scare them too much. But I sat up, and one of the wolves, well, they all looked over towards me, the ones that were aware, looked over towards me. And I don't know why I did what I did, but when you're 21, you don't need an excuse. I was 2,500, 3,500 kilometers north of my parents, so I did what I want. And I put my beak to the sky, and I howled. And the one wolf, which was probably the alpha, male or female, I don't know, she got up or he got up and looked at me and then sat down and then put its mouth to the sky and let out a howl back.
Oh, my God.
And David, I was just vibrating with excitement. It was so powerful. And ever since then, well, and before then, but that was one of the solidifying moments. I've been looking to recreate those kinds of moments and those kinds of adrenaline rushes in the wild ever since.
It's amazing, because you think, as a species, that would have been a more common experience even 100 years ago or 200 years ago. And it's really only very recently that we've removed ourselves from all of that. And I sort of question the wisdom. Yeah. Ultimately, you know.
No, it's true. We've trained the world's wildlife to be fearful of us for a good reason. We're not very polite.
No, not at all. No, that's amazing. Such amazing experiences. I mean, is there a place that you Zimbabwe sounds like one place you've gone back to and you continue to go back to. Are there other places that really have sort of found their way into your heart in that kind of way?
You know, for a few years back, we did our first trip into the Himalaya. Actually, it was probably 15 years ago or so when I went and teamed up with Rodney Jackson, who is the he and his girlfriend Darla Hillard wrote the book 5 Years Amongst the Snow Leopards, and they did this remarkable study, a multi-year study of snow leopards, and he won a Rolex award to give him the funding to get in there to start the program. Rodney is still very much involved. Both Rodney and Darla are still very much involved with snow leopards. They run the Snow Leopard Conservancy, which has become very successful. And I would guess that he has saved dozens and dozens, probably hundreds of snow leopards from death over the years with his work with the local people in the highlands, trying to create a situation where they accepted the snow leopards. And that's worked. He's developed a systematic program to make snow leopards, as the locals say, the pearls in the necklace around the mountain. Whereas the locals used to, they wouldn't necessarily go out and hunt them and kill them, because they're Buddhists. But if the snow leopard came in and killed all their sheep or took some goats, of course, then they would go after them, and that's called retaliatory killing. And if it was my goat and my sheep, I would do the same thing.
Yeah.
If I was depending upon those animals for my livelihood. And so he introduced the concept of homestays in the 8 or so villages in his study area, where houses that have a good system set up to allow a foreigner to come in can pay a fee. The foreigners will pay a fee for a meal and an overnight stay, or many overnight stays, and basically a night in a homestay pays for permission, so to speak, of the snow leopard to take a goat that year from their flock. So in other words, there is a monetary reward for not killing snow leopards by having these homestays, because of course the people who are coming and staying there are searching for snow leopards. And it's become a very, very popular program. Their sightings of snow leopards are frequent. So in the day, you know, when I went, it was kind of a new thing on the block. We did stay in a homestay for a night, but we tented up in the highlands for the 2 weeks, and temperatures got very cold at night. During the day, they usually went above freezing, but they were clear blue sky days, and we hiked every day, all day, looking for snow leopard scat or tracks, or even, you know, smelling urine stains on rocks to give it a number to find out, you know, to delineate how recent the snow leopard was there. Snow leopards in March, they're coming down from the high country because the snow is too high, too thick up there to hunt effectively. And it's also their breeding season. So the snow leopards essentially want to be seen. So they're putting out all these calling cards for other snow leopards. And we were rewarded with a sighting that I'll never forget. It was the second to last day, and a local villager who knew that we were in the area looking for snow leopards came running and saying that he found a snow leopard on a kill. So, David, I've never run so hard and so fast in all my life at 12,000 feet. I thought my heart was going to explode. But we got to the snow leopard before it left the kill, and it had moved off the kill, but only up about 20 meters. So we sat there watching it for about an hour and a half before it got too dark to watch it anymore. And then we came back early in the morning. It had already come back down to the kill and fed on the rest of the carcass during the night, and it had left. But to see a snow leopard in the wild like that, to see its kill, and it had killed a full curl blue sheep, which they look like our bighorn sheep here, a bit thinner of a build. They're the Himalayan equivalent. And it had taken down an adult male.
Wow.
It was something I'll never forget.
Yeah, that's one of the rarest of the rare, isn't it? Snow leopard.
Yeah, George Schaller was the first non-local person to ever see one in the wild, and he photographed it, got it into National Geographic. That's where Rodney got the idea to do the study, was from his photograph out of National Geo. But there's been other researchers that have gone in there and have searched for 3 or 4 months and not come up with a snow leopard. So they are the ghosts of the Himalaya.
Yeah, what an amazing experience. Have there ever been moments when you've been leading an expedition where there's been a bit of a scare, and maybe like, oh, I'm gone a little further than we should have gone here?
You know, only once with a group, and that was a buffalo, a Cape buffalo. We were canoeing the Zambezi River, and I was the third or fourth canoe back, and I saw a lone buffalo, which they're usually, you know, you just give them their space and paddle past them. He was standing up to his ankles in water. And we were in a deeper channel next to the edge, next to the land, the edge of the river. And we were canoeing down, and I don't know what it was, but the buffalo decided that he didn't like us, and he charged. And I was filming it the whole time. So I was lucky, because I wanted to get the shot of the buffalo in the background, and the people in the canoe compress that shot, makes the buffalo look a little bit closer. And it's kind of just a neat wildlife shot. I had no idea what was going to happen, but the buffalo charged the first canoe. Our quick thinking guide took out his pistol and shot it in the air. You can't shoot a buffalo with a pistol. It'll just anger it.
Yeah.
Shot it in the air. That deflected the buffalo over. I was still filming, and then it turned to the next canoe and started coming straight towards them. Our guide shot the pistol in the air again. The buffalo deflected again, but then it started towards me, towards my wife and I. And just before I dropped the camera, which then hit the bottom of the canoe with a kerthunk, you could hear my wife saying, quick, Brian. And then all hell broke loose, of course. But fortunately, our guide shot for the third time, and the buffalo veered off and then just kept going past us and off into the woods. But that was a close call. But when my wife and I have been exploring on our own, we've had a couple. And you know, David, I don't really like talking about it too much because I don't want to scare people about being in the African wilds. But we've had a lot of experience in the wild. We probably, if you were to add it up, it's been over 3 years in the bush, in big mammal country. And, you know, stuff happens. And you're bound to have a situation that that puts you into a bit of an adrenaline moment. And I think there's a couple of those. One was when we were with a good friend of ours who's a professional safari guide, and he and my wife and I were going to, my wife and I were going to spend a week at this wilderness location, just camping in our tent, watching animals come down to a spring that develops during the dry season. And so we just wanted to spend a week there. And we had done it a couple of years prior, a couple of years in a row. But we stopped there, and Garth was going to spend the first night with us, and then I was going to drive him back to the airstrip the next day to catch a ride back to Harare. But Garth said, look, let's just break up and see where we want to put our tent tonight to watch. You know, it was going to be a full moon night. We wanted to watch as much wildlife as possible come down to the water. So we went to the right. He went to the left. When we met at the eye of the spring about a kilometer and a half up, he said that he came across the male lion. He had passed the females earlier on, and they were all happily chilling out under the shade of a tree. And then he came across the male lion, and there was a big, deep ravine between us and the male lion. So Garth said, let's just go back and watch him for a little while, and because there's elephants in the background feeding on trees, so it'd be kind of fun just to spend some time with this big male lion. So we started walking towards that. We could see the male lion. And look, David, we weren't going in to push any buttons. We were staying a long ways away. And we knew the male lion would know as well as us that there was this deep ravine between us and him. So there's no way we could surprise the male lion. And he looked over at us with indifference and then looked away. But then we walked right up to the edge of the ravine. And for the first time in my life, I had a premonition that I was making a mistake. And I took one step further, and we were looking into the eyes of four lionesses and two cubs. And the fourth lioness with the two cubs exited stage left down the ravine like a shot. The other three lioness jumped up at us. And we ran backwards. You never turn your back on a lion. That's been drilled into me from day one. We ran backwards, yelling at the tops of our lungs. And the lions came up towards us. Their teeth were pulled back in grimace. The noise was beyond belief. The muscles rippling through their body. You could see their claws were out. They were moving at us fast and then stopping. And every time they stopped, a big puff of dust. And then they would move at us again fast. We kept running backwards, kept running backwards. I kept looking over my shoulder to make sure I wasn't going to trip on some of the root stumps that were sticking up that the elephants had created by knocking down some of the smaller bush. And finally, one lioness stopped, then the second lioness stopped, then the third one kept coming. Finally, she stopped. We kept running back for another 100 meters at least. And finally, we decided this was, you know, they had stopped. Now they were going to retreat. And then just when we stopped, I saw the male lion disappear into one of the tributaries of that ravine that we had just scared the cubs from. And he shot out like a spitball at us. And fortunately, I carried a bear branger, which is about the size of a pen. It's got a .22 caliber shell, and it releases a ballistic that goes off about 50 feet before it explodes like a magnesium bomb. And I got it off just in the nick of time. It went right over. So when I set it off, the .22 shell made the lion hesitate a bit, but he was still coming towards us. And remember, this is all happening in split seconds. And then the burst went off right above his head, about maybe 2 meters above his head. And he stopped like a glass wall was put in front of him. And he turned right around and ran towards his girls. And the three females ran in line with behind him as he ran past them. And we turned around the other way and ran like crazy back to the eye of the spring. And we sat underneath the shade of a tree, and we compared shaking hands. And we giggled for about 15 or 20 minutes until our adrenaline level went down. Then we walked back to where the site was so we could look at our tracks and to see the lion's tracks so that we could tell the story without exaggerating it. But that was a real adrenaline moment.
Wow. Yeah, I don't encourage people to have those moments, obviously, but there is that humbling thing about having an experience like that, you know?
You're right, David. Sorry to interrupt, but we were reading about this afterwards with how the Bushmen, because they're known for going up to a lion that's on a kill and scaring the lion off the kill and stealing the kill. And they do it with bravado and with lots of loud screaming. And they basically intimidate the lion into thinking that the human is more powerful than the lion. But then they, after they are successful in that type of you know, of stealing of somebody else's meat, they'll sit and giggle for 45 minutes or a half an hour as well. So it seems to be a human response. And I guess in a sense, we've co-evolved with big predators. And we, you know, this is probably something that just came out in the three of us after we had that experience.
No kidding. It's good to know it's still in there. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, my God. That means amazing experiences. And I don't want to keep you too long, but I know you've been to all seven continents. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. And so are there places you haven't been to yet that you still want to get to?
Well, my gosh. You know, just last month I was in the Antarctic and I hadn't been there since COVID. So that was a real treat. A place that I've wanted to get to for a long, long time is up into the highlands of Tibet and experience some of those high elevation mountain environments and some of the unique wildlife that lives up there and the people that are there. I've heard wonderful stories, but I think I need a good chunk of time, a couple of months to do that properly. But I've been hiking in Bhutan, and I know that there was a trail that I passed that with an arrow pointing up, and I asked my guide where that went. And he said, if you walk up there for an hour, you'll be in Tibet. But the trouble is, if you do that, you'll get arrested and then you'll be thrown in jail because you don't have the right paperwork to do that.
Yeah. Don't want to be in a Chinese jail at this point. No.
No, I don't think so. But I would love to do that someday, get up there. Yeah. I mean, that kind of environment intrigues me a lot. And the world's a big place.
Yeah, we've had Wade Davis on the podcast, and his book about the Mallory expedition up in that territory is just one of my favorite reads. Yeah.
Yes,
it sounds like an amazing part of the world. I haven't been there myself. So one question I ask everyone before I let them go is to name a favorite place in Canada. I have to insist you pin it down to a place.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I would have to say our own Rocky Mountains, and a specific place in the Rocky Mountains. There's a couple of high elevation locations that are dotted with alpine lakes that I've been to several times over the last four decades. And I would have to say it's that. You know, I think we are very lucky to have the intact wilderness we still have. And, you know, that's everything is changing, and we all know that, and the human population is definitely growing. But we still live in a relatively unpopulated part of the world. And it's not that I have anything against people. It's just nice to be out there in the wild landscapes and feel like you're the only person on the planet with your partner. And it's those places that I long for, and that, in the middle of winter, I think about those, especially the springtime up in the high country where the birds are just starting to declare territories and seek out mates and establish nests, and the tundras thawing and starting to put forth its unbelievable bouquet of color and flowers. I think those are the real special parts of Canada that I really enjoy.
Yeah, magical, magical. I find it's not so much getting away from people as it is getting away from my smartphone. I think that's
getting into an area where they don't work.
There's no signal. That's the key.
Yeah, no, you're right. And that's a big issue these days. I think we're all so addicted and attached to our screens. It sometimes blinds us to the beauty of the world that's at our doorstep. And I think that's what COVID taught me was how much we have in our own backyard. My gosh, we did some good exploring into places that I have virtually ignored since my high school days or heard about but not investigated. And it opened up a whole new world. And it's right at our doorstep. It's not hard to get to, and they're out there. But you gotta put the phone away for sure.
Yeah, we're very, very lucky. Well, listen, I'd be very lucky to have you on as well, Brian. I know we could probably talk for hours and we could pick this up some other time. I'd love to. But thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
You're welcome, David. It's a real privilege.
And thanks to all of you for listening. If you enjoy this podcast, please tell a friend about it. Do it in person if possible. It's the best way to help more people discover these conversations. And please give us a 5-star rating and review us where you listen. We love to get your feedback. Until next time, when we'll explore again, I'm David McGuffin.
I think right now we're enjoying very much looking back at the Earth, and it's just a fantastic experience, and I just can't wait to get back and start telling people.
We left Simpson about June 10th with a fur brigade consisting of a number of York boats, each manned by 10 voyageurs.
For us, it means that in the order. natural history is very strong.
And we flew low over every inch of the country that could be. We were hoping that he would fire at us.
Oh, I guess 160 dives or so. There are shrimp fishing swimming around outside. It's just fabulous here.
Well, another first for Canada.